fascinating aspects of the Reformation. But I suppose also one of the sad aspects of the Reformation is the people that got hurt by it. I think one of the most remarkable characteristics of Lutheran Reformation as well as the Protestant Reformation is that Luther died in bed, died with his boots on, and John Calvin lived to a ripe old age, and some of the other people that achieved some attention during the Reformation years died very unhappy, very disillusioned. One of them was John Staupitz, who I'm sure died very bitter, middle-aged man, not really an old man, but an embittered man, and hating Luther. He undoubtedly left the Augustinian order because it was made quite evident to him that if he left, nobody would object. He was probably blamed by his order and by the papal court for the whole Lutheran business, and undoubtedly many people told him how they would have handled it if they had been in his position. But he got the blame for not putting the fire out and for splitting the church. The man we're going to talk about today, what we know about him is about a year of his life. And his story is probably an even sadder one than the life of Staupitz. According to tradition that dates back almost to Luther's life, the first contact between Luther and Tetzel took place about 1516, when Luther was the district supervisor for the Augustinian order as the sub-prior at Wittenberg. He made a visit to the village of Grimma in 1516, and the people there told him that there had recently been a hawker of indulgences who had come to town and had taken all the money out of the community. And Luther is supposed to have responded, "I'll put a hole in his drum." Now, Tetzel was famous for having a drummer boy with him, and they beat the drums every time somebody bought an indulgence, and then he said, "As soon as the money clinks in the chest, the soul for whom you bought the indulgence will spring to heaven." Well, Tetzel was probably the first fundraiser, the first professional fundraiser in the history of Christianity, one who would have a great many successors. At any rate, he was born in 1465, which makes him 18 years older than Luther. He was born in a small town called Meissen. His father was a goldsmith, and the family name was Dietz. And he went by the name as an adult, Dietzel, you know, little Dietz. Perhaps he picked it up as a nickname when he was a kid, Dietzel, which then got to be changed to Tetzel. So we know him as Tetzel, but his name probably was really Dietz. He went to the University of Leipzig, as did Staupitz before him, and Leipzig was the leading German university. Leipzig and Heidelberg were the two great universities, and Leipzig was probably at this time a greater university than Heidelberg was. He began to attend there in 1482 when he was 17 years old. He received the Bachelor of Arts degree in 1487, so it took him 5 years to get it. But at the same time, he graduated sixth in a class of 56, so he wasn't too dumb. And he immediately became a Dominican monk. He entered the Dominican monastery at Pirna, which is a suburb of Leipzig. And there are a lot of stories about him. Now, of course, Tetzel, like Luther, was a very controversial person. And there are all kinds of stories that gather about the heads of controversial persons. Good stories by their supporters and bad stories by people that didn't like them. And there seems at the time to have been a kind of a natural matching in the public imagination of Luther and Tetzel. Luther on one side, Tetzel on the other side. And Tetzel did attempt to involve Luther in some writing polemics, and Luther just simply ignored him. But at any rate, he joined the Dominican monastery, and there is some indication that a few years later he was involved in some frictions within his monastery. In other words, that he wasn't getting along with some of the other monks. Now, what is very likely, considering his future career, what was very likely was that, you know, what we would say in psychology today, was that he had a few ego problems. He was a real gung-ho, get-aheader type guy, and this probably rubbed some of the older monks the wrong way. Well, at any rate, he was involved in some friction, and he actually made a trip all the way to Rome in 1497 to get permission from the head of his order to transfer to another monastery. And he didn't even go by writing. He made a trip to Rome to get permission to get out of the monastery where he was in Leipzig and to get to another one. He went to Poland, which was not exactly the heartland of culture and refinement. So undoubtedly, it was a kind of a step down to go to Poland from Leipzig. And there weren't any great universities in Poland, so it was probably a bit of a demotion. But at the same time, in rather short order, he became prior of his monastery, a little town called Glogau in Poland. And after about 10 years or so, he was appointed inquisitor for Poland. Now, I've got to explain to you what an inquisitor is, because we all think of inquisitor, you know, as Spain burning at the stake, the whole bit, you know. Inquisitor comes from the Latin word which means questioner. And the inquisitor of the order was a man who was responsible to conduct investigations in case of problems, the one who went around and asked questions as to determine what the issue was, what the problems were, and how to solve it. It's interesting to note that he was appointed inquisitor by a man named Cajetan, about whom I'll talk tomorrow, Cardinal Cajetan. He was the one who was sent to Luther to settle the Luther business. Well, he was appointed by Cajetan. Cajetan was a Dominican. While he was in Poland, he received permission from his order to study for a doctorate in theology. And so about 1500, he was transferred back to Leipzig to begin doctoral studies. He never completed doctoral studies. He was made inquisitor for the Saxon provinces, which suggests that he must have been pretty good at it in Poland to be appointed this to this position, and he got to be rather well known. Now, this is the first time that the term inquisitor has come in. The Dominicans were a teaching order, just as the Augustinians were, although the Augustinians were also a preaching order and the Dominicans weren't. So virtually every Augustinian was a priest. This also tends to be the case today with the Jesuits. Virtually every Jesuit is a priest, and they are both teachers and preachers. At this particular time, the Dominicans and the Augustinians were involved in the power struggle as to who was going to be top dog of the monastic orders. It happened to be that the Augustinians were at the time. They had the ear of the Pope, the Dominicans didn't. And so when you ought to be the most important religious group, what do you tend to do theologically? You become a defender of pure doctrine. And so they presented themselves as the conservative religious order, and then tried to push the Augustinians off to be the liberals. And of course, Martin Luther didn't hurt the Dominican cause one bit. Well, at any rate, they became very interested in playing the role within the church of being the safeguarders of pure doctrine. Now, those of you that know something about recent Lutheran church history are going to find a great many things that sound very familiar in the early career of Martin Luther and his associations with John Tetzel. You may think that history repeats itself. At any rate, they wanted to be the safeguarders of true doctrine, so what they began to become were heresy hunters. And so to be a Dominican was to be a hunter for heretics, self-appointed. And so they would go about the country, and they would try to find whether pure doctrine is being taught or not. One of the ironic things about it is that a great many of the Dominicans could neither read nor write. And so there was a certain element of anti-intellectualism involved there also. At the same time, there were some quite distinguished Dominican doctors of theology. Probably the most distinguished one was one that you've heard of, Dr. Eck from Leipzig University. Unfortunately, his opponents ran those two words together to D-R-E-C-K, to Dreck, and everybody that knows German knows that Dreck means manure. You know, so the opponents of him, you know, called him Dreck, you know, manure, including Martin Luther. Yes, ma'am.
How could they be Dominican or come to the monastery and not been able to read and write?
Oh, you didn't necessarily have to be able to read and write unless you belonged to a scholarly order.
What did you do then?
Well, you know, you washed dishes in the kitchen, you were a cook, you gardened. You know, there were a lot of jobs in the monastery that, you know, that simply called, you know, for hand labor, and you didn't have to be able to read. Most people couldn't read and write, and, you know, it was common. You know, it was the exceptional person that could read and write. And usually the people that could read and write were either from the noble class or from the church. And oftentimes also, the religious orders would get children of nobility that were slow intellectually, you know, or near feeble-minded or so on, and so they'd become a part of the order, and, you know, the order looked after them, and they were incapable of learning to read and write. So to belong to a monastic order didn't necessarily mean that you could read and write. All right, so they sought from the Pope to be given the task of being the official censor and inquisitor for the church. In other words, to decide what was right and wrong. Quite obviously, they were generally disliked in the church. You know, because, you know, nobody wants somebody come around, stooping around, looking over your shoulder, accusing you of this, accusing you of that. And they could be kind of sneaky in what they did. So the Dominican order, by and large, was a disliked order. At the same time, it just happened that at this time, the Dominicans had succeeded in getting control of the Roman Curia. In other words, the court which surrounded the Pope. This was largely Dominican, and it was Dominican dominated, and so consequently they were able to influence Paul II much more so than they had been able to influence previous popes, because they got control of strategic positions at the papal court, and then they filled in, you know, all the positions they could with members of their order, and at the same time tried to squeeze out the Augustinians. And so consequently, what the Pope tended to hear in Rome was the Dominican version of what was going on in Germany. Okay. By virtue of the fact that Tetzel was made inquisitor for the provinces of Saxony, he got to be fairly well known. In 1503, just purely by chance, he was asked to handle an indulgence sale for the Teutonic Knights of Livonia. And he revealed himself as a natural-born salesman and fundraiser. It was a smashing success. Well, quite obviously, what happens in the church when somebody's good at raising money? They stand in line waiting to hire the guy, and this is what happened with Tetzel. In 1506, he was asked to take charge of an indulgence campaign to raise money over a period of 3 years in Cologne, Mainz, and Trier. Now, these are three cities along the Rhine River. In 1509, he carried out a little job for the city of Strasbourg and raised some money there. In 1510, he was hired to raise money by indulgence sales at Nuremberg, Würzburg, and Bamberg, which were in southern Germany. In between 1510 and April 1516, we don't know with any accuracy what happened in Tetzel's life. There are all kinds of stories about him, most of them dirty. And they really ground him out after the Reformation. For instance, it is claimed that in this period of time he got caught committing adultery, and he was condemned to be thrown in the Rhine River, tied up in a gunny sack. And the last minute, the elector saved him, gave him another job raising money. They claimed that at one time he was traveling around selling indulgences, and two of his illegitimate children were with him. You know, so there are all kinds of stories like this. We don't know. Giving him the benefit of the doubt, let's just say it's not true. But there were just gobs of stories like this that after his death circulated around about him. But at any rate, we don't know what he was doing during these years, but all of a sudden in 1516, he pops up as the chief German indulgence salesman for the building of St. Peter's in Rome. He was getting a very big salary, even for a Dominican. He had his own professional staff, an excellent carriage, three horses, and a big expense account. He lived very well, and he was the indulgence sale really was going well. The money was flowing down from Germany to Rome for the building of St. Peter's. As I mentioned, the technique which he used was he had a great big cask there with money in it, and he said as soon as the money went into the cask, you know, the sound of the money clinking there was a signal down in hell, and the soul of the damned or of the soul in purgatory, was released and immediately flew up to heaven. He apparently was very good at PR, and he apparently was a very dramatic operator. I think probably one of the few good scenes and fairly accurate scenes in Osborne's Luther is the scene of Tetzel selling indulgences. It's the most colorful scene, and it's just utterly delightful. And you split a gut listening to him. And, you know, the dialogue is just full of jokes and subtle suggestions and so on. And it's probably a fairly accurate picture of how successful the guy was. And he was, he could charm the ducats out of your pocket. Used to know a district president in my church years ago who was very good at fundraising, and the church used to use him in that way also. And I remember one time going to a circuit meeting where he was talking, and I went with an elderly gentleman who happened to be the chairman of our board of deacons, and after he got done with his eloquent presentation, this elderly gentleman turned to me and he says, boy, he could talk your wallet right out of your pocket. Well, Tetzel apparently was good at it also, and he could really milk an area. Well, Staupitz comes in here. Staupitz got the ear of the emperor, and he said, or the ear of the elector, and he said, don't allow this man in Saxony. Don't allow him, and if you can't avoid that, keep him out of Wittenberg, because my faculty will take him apart. Well, Tetzel didn't come to Wittenberg, but he did come to a couple of little towns called Jeterborg and Serbst, which were about 4 miles away from Wittenberg. And the Wittenbergers all went over there and they bought their indulgences, like buying lottery tickets, and they brought them back in Luther. So he began selling in April of 1517. Luther sent word over to him and also to the elector, don't let this man do this stuff. And it kept on, and finally Luther posted the 95 Theses on the castle church door on October 31st, 1517. Why did he do it then? Because the next day was All Saints' Day, which in Luther's day had gotten to be one of the biggest festival days in the church year. It was the day on which they open up the doors to the upper floor of the castle church where all the relics were stored, you know, and you could go around and see all the relics. You could really collect yourself a lot of years that you escaped from purgatory in one day, and so it was extremely popular, and the crowds came. There's some reason to believe that Staupitz didn't have to appeal to the elector too much, because the elector was operating his own little get out of purgatory operation himself with all the relics. I read once somewhere that you could in one day's time, you know, if you made the rounds well and pushed your way through the crowd in the relics room, that you could get yourself 2,000 years out of purgatory in one day. You know, in a lifetime that could amount up to a great many years. And so I'm sure the elector didn't appreciate, well, he didn't charge admission or anything like that. I'm sure he didn't appreciate some guy 4 miles away selling it when he was giving it away, you know, indulgence from purgatory. So at any rate, Luther put the 95 Theses up. They were printed and circulated all over Germany in rather short order. And there were three kinds of reactions to this event. Apparently a small little event. Three kinds of reactions: political reaction, popular reaction, and an ecclesiastical reaction. Now you can imagine that there would likely be a popular reaction, because, you know, if some guy, you know, posts a document and he says salvation is free, you don't have to pay for it, and you got Tetzel going around and, you know, and milking every nickel you got, or you're not going to get to heaven, you can imagine which guy you want to go along with. See? The guy who's giving it away free, who was Martin Luther. So, you know, everybody starts saying, hey, what's doing here? This, you know, this guy comes from Rome and he's milking dough out of us. You know, those WOPs down south there, and they hated the Italians. Those WOPs down south are just trying to get our gold. German money to build an Italian cathedral down in Rome. So it was a notable issue. The reason why this particular indulgence sale was going on at the same time that Tetzel was also raising money for St. Peter's was the fact that Duke Albert of Brandenburg needed money. Now, Albert of Brandenburg was a member of the Hohenzollern family. And the Hohenzollern family is the traditional Prussian royal family of northern Germany. And the last Hohenzollern to hold political office was Kaiser William II, who was the ruler of Germany at the time of World War I. But at this time, the Hohenzollerns didn't control much. They controlled what, prior to World War II, was called East Prussia, over at Königsberg, on the other side of Poland. They had a few hunks of land around Berlin, and they were trying very hard, as were certain other families, to consolidate their power and to expand their power. One of the ways in which you expanded power was by winning wars and annexing land. Another way whereby you consolidated power was by buying church offices. Because where a member of your family was the top dog, the bishop, there you also could have political influence. And so consequently, Albert, who was the second son, first son was always scheduled to succeed his father. The second son was planned to have a career in the church, and the third son was planned to have a military career. And if he had any more sons, they were clerics. Because you only had one title to pass on, and you only needed one son and a couple of backup sons in case that one died or got killed in a war. See, other than that, you didn't need any more sons. So you had surplus sons, and, you know, what does a noble do? He sure can't go out and dig ditches. So, you made monks out of them. It also was a great form of birth control. At least legitimate birth control. Some of them were messed around a bit. But it was a great form of birth control in the family also. And because the more sons you had, all you gotta do is look at the history of the British kings, and they didn't have this much sense. The more sons you had that had kids, the more pretenders to the throne there were for the next generation. And so, if you had most of your sons in the church, they didn't get married, they didn't have any children, there were no legitimate people to compete for the throne, and so you could have a fairly peaceful control by your family. Now, just so long as the oldest son wasn't sterile, you were in pretty good shape. And even if he was the one that was a military general, you could always pull him back and put him in charge. And so at any rate, this business about the oldest son the heir, the next son the church, the next son the military, and the rest of them in the church, there was a certain reason for a lot of these things being done. Well, at any rate, Albert was the one who was destined to have power in the church. When he was 23 years old, three bishoprics happened to become vacant at once. One was at Magdeburg, which was near where Luther was. One was at Halberstadt, which was in middle Germany. And one was at Mainz, and it was on the Rhine River in western Germany. And the Hohenzollern family nominated Albert for all three. And Albert got all three because he bid the highest for the jobs. He bought them. And so he got his money, I think, from the Fuggers of Austria, who were the big German money-lending family. And so they borrowed. He borrowed the money to buy the offices, and now he had to have some source of revenue to get money to pay off the loan that he had gotten. And so he got permission from the Pope to have an 8-year indulgence sale in order to raise the amount of money he needed to recoup the amount of money he had had to spend in order to become bishop of three different bishoprics. Now, the Pope in Rome was also rather good at financing. And so the deal that he worked out with Albert was they would split the take down the middle 50-50. And Albert would also kick in an extra 10,000 gold ducats. And the Pope didn't have to do any work at all. Albert had to do all the work. He had to hire the guys that would sell the indulgences, you know, pay for the paper and the hand lettering and the whole bit, you know. And he had to cover the expenses for Tetzel and his boys, you know, and the Pope just simply collected half plus 10,000. It was a good deal for the Pope. Well, Luther's attack put an immediate dent in money raising. And so Albert protested to the Pope. Tetzel protested to Albert. And people in general protested about Tetzel. Most of the people were favorable to Luther. From a political standpoint, Luther sent Albert of Mainz a copy of his 95 Theses. Now Luther, I think probably most of Luther's life, he was politically naive, incredibly naive politically. You know, he just had led that sheltered life and he just didn't know how things operated in the world of politics. I think this is part of the reason why he made a number of wrong political moves, like his opposition to the Peasants' War and so on. But at any rate, just simply out of courtesy, he sent Albert a copy of his 95 Theses, and he sent it to him the very same day that he posted them. Albert sent the Theses over to the Council of Halle, which was an economic council, and the faculty of Mainz University. Mainz University was about like Podunk U. See, it even sounds that way. Mainz University. It didn't last much longer. Well, Wittenberg didn't either. Luther pretty well killed that one off. But Mainz University was the pride and joy of the Upper Rhine Valley, and it just never got anywhere. But he asked the theological faculty there for an opinion. The opinion which he got was, it sounds kind of suspicious to us, you know, but they couldn't pinpoint it. And they suggested send it to Rome and get a good opinion from the faculty or from the College of Cardinals there. Somehow or other, the Emperor Maximilian, who was the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire at this time, got a copy of the 95 Theses. He was no dummy. He read it, and he sent a letter, which I think is still extant. He sent a letter to the Elector of Saxony, wherein he said, look out for this man. We may need him against Rome. It's kind of interesting. And the Elector apparently paid attention. One of the fascinating things about Charles V, who succeeded Maximilian, and I'll talk about him on Friday, One of the fascinating things about Charles V is that Charles V, unlike Maximilian, was a loyal defender of the church all of his professional career, and at the same time he spent most of his time fighting the Pope on the field of battle as the Pope was trying to expand his own personal temporal power. And it's, you know, another one of the ironies of the time. Okay, well, as I mentioned, the papal curia was dominated by Dominicans, and their leading theologian was Cardinal Cajetan. He was the head of the Dominican order. The official censor of the church was a man named Prierius, who was also a member of the Dominican order. So in other words, they had the whole thing cornered. If Luther had appealed to the Pope and to the Rome in this debate, the guys who would have decided the case would have been Tetzel's fellow order, members of Tetzel's order. It would have been a loaded court. He wouldn't have had a chance of getting a fair hearing. And there was reason to believe that Luther knew this. But at any rate, the first political move by the Pope came in late spring of 1518. Now, this is about 6 months after Luther has put the 95 Theses on the door. He contacted the head of the Augustinian order, and he told him, "We have a little bit of problem up here in Germany with one of your Augustinian monks. I want it cooled. I want it settled. You handle it." Luther then was asked to present his position on the subject of indulgences at the next meeting of the Augustinian order, which was held in Heidelberg. And Luther then presented what have since come to be known as the Heidelberg Theses. It was the new theology, April 25, 1518. The order was very enthusiastic. They were very impressed with the theology of Luther, and it was new theology, and terrific. They were all excited about it. Most of them were all excited about it. Though this, of course, was not what the Pope had wanted to happen. You know, the order supported Luther and said this was good. So that summer, the Pope appointed a new head to the Augustinian order. You get rid of the old one, you put in a new guy, and you tell, you cool it. That's your job. That's why you're in as the head. At the same time, he appointed a man named Hecker in Saxony to be in charge of the area. And Hecker was the leader of the faction that was against Staupitz and his men. So, in other words, what the Pope did was make some significant changes of positions in order to isolate Luther and in order to snuff out what was going on and keep it within the Augustinian order. At the same time, Tetzel and other Dominicans began to gather data in preparation for accusing Luther of heresy. The Dominican order interpreted the attack on Tetzel as a personal attack on the Dominican order, and they began to gear up for political counter moves against the Augustinians. And they saw this as the Augustinians against the Dominicans. They saw themselves as a conservative, preservers of doctrine, censors of the church, and in the inquisitors, the questioners of heretics. And, of course, they then saw the Augustinians as introducing new liberal theology into the church. The order to which Tetzel belonged sent a friar to Wittenberg to scare the Augustinians and to shut up Luther. And the Order of Saxon Dominicans called a meeting for January 1518 at Frankfurt under Oder, which is the Eastern Germany Frankfurt. In the fall of 1517, late in the fall of 1517, after Luther had posted the 95 Theses, he also preached a sermon which he published, and it was entitled On Indulgences and Grace, or an alternative title was Indulgences Against Grace. Tetzel wrote a treatise that was a response to that, and in the following May, he published 50 theses opposed to Luther's 95 theses. Hardly anybody read them. And those that did look at them, the response tended to be, gee, he could only come up with 50. You know, Luther had 95, he can only come up with 50. And so, you know, it was a kind of an embarrassing sort of thing. The Dominicans were supposed to meet in the early spring. They didn't get started until late. And then they delayed it even further because there was a big event that was about to occur. Tetzel was about to get an honorary Doctor of Divinity degree. A little more politics going on. See, we got to make Tetzel a doctor now because Luther's a doctor, you know, so we make him an honorary doctor. In preparation for receiving the doctorate, one of the things you had to do was to deliver a public oration and then defend it. He prepared 106 theses in defense of indulgences against Luther, so he was able to double the output of the previous year. An apparently good authority, we know that the 106 theses called the Frankfurt Theses were written by his academic advisor. So in other words, they hustled him through his doctorate. A man named Conrad Wimpina, who was the rector, today I suppose we would say he was sort of the president of Frankfurt U, which was another one of the great universities like Mainz U. It was a brand new university, only a few years old, and Tetzel gets a Doctor of Divinity degree from Frankfurt University, his thesis being written by his academic advisor. Well, the whole thing was hustle, hustle, hustle. Make it look good. Big event. Tetzel has just, you know, his dissertation was an absolute refutation of Martin Luther and everything he stands for, and he's gotten his degree, you know, and here's Dr. Tetzel. Okay. The Dominicans also began to send spies to listen to Luther's sermons and to take notes down. They also began to publish spurious documents over Luther's name and sent copies of them to Rome with outraged complaints. Sounds like American politics, doesn't it? They arranged for Luther to be invited to Dresden, which wasn't a great many miles away, to preach. He was a guest preacher. And a banquet was held in his honor. At the banquet, they got him angry, and they carefully wrote down word for word everything that he said when he got mad. And they sent that to Rome. So in other words, there was a steady stream of data against Martin Luther being sent to Rome by the Dominicans. Second papal move. The first papal move was, okay, you Augustinians, shut this guy up, solve this problem, don't care how you do it, but shut him up. And that didn't work. All right, so the second move was in October of 1518. The Dominicans met in Rome for a general council. One of the decisions of the Dominican General Council was they condemned Luther and his doctrines. On the basis of the 95 theses and the spurious documents which members of their order had written. And the matter was then referred to the papal curia to make an official decision on behalf of the church. And, you know, virtually everybody in the curia was a member of the order. They decided that the situation was so serious that it should be referred to Prierius, the censor, and he decided that they should have a heresy trial at Rome before the leading theologians of the Roman Curia. And so Luther received an instruction from the Pope to come to Rome to get his head on straight. The Elector of Saxony arranged that it be transferred to Augsburg. But he did have to compromise, and it was Cardinal Cajetan, the head of the Dominican order, who was sent by Rome, who was supposed to conduct the hearing. And I told you yesterday about what happened when Luther was before Cajetan. Cajetan, before he left Rome, also received authority from the Pope to imprison Luther, if he wished. I did not receive authority to execute him, but he did receive authority to have him put in prison. Well, things were beginning not to go too well for Tetzel. He was beginning to suffer from popular disapproval. All kinds of stories were beginning to circulate around about him, so that he was beginning to get a very bad reputation. People who had been very strong in support of him began to disappear. His life got difficult for him. His fundraising business was over and done with. He wasn't on an expense account. His fellow Dominicans weren't too happy to have him staying at their monastery. And as a result of this, he experienced at least a nervous breakdown. But his physical health also began to break down, and he went to St. Paul's Convent, which was a sort of hospital recovery type convent in Leipzig. Luther learned, and it's kind of interesting insight into Luther at this time, Luther at Wittenberg learned that Tetzel was ill and where he was, and he sent a letter to him. And in the letter, he said, he told him, you know, don't be concerned about, you know, the controversy in which I'm involved. It's not your fault. You were an unwitting pawn in the whole thing. And, quote from the letter, this child had an entirely different father. In other words, you weren't the father of what has happened here. Okay. Right about this time, Emperor Maximilian died. The throne of the Holy Roman Empire is vacant. The Elector of Saxony is one of the seven electors, each one of which has one vote. Albert of Mainz also happened to have a vote, his family's vote. And of course, the family wanted a member of their family on the throne. They didn't get it. Okay, so we get a third political move by the Pope. Karl von Miltitz is English, was a Saxon layman. He was sent as papal legate to the Elector of Saxony to make an appeal on behalf of the noble knights of Saxony. He also had an award to give to the elector. It was called the Award of the Golden Rose, which was about the highest papal decoration which one could get. And it just so happened that the Pope wanted to bestow this on the elector at this time. And Karl von Miltitz was sent to present it to him. And in the course of the presentation and the conversation, so on, back and forth, Carl von Miltitz, as gently as he could, said to the elector, "Shut up, Luther." So now we've moved from the Augustinians getting the word to shut up Luther, the Dominicans trying to shut up Luther. We move now to the lay world, to the secular world, to the non-clerical world, and the elector is told, shut him up. But it's shut him up, please, because the elector shortly is going to have to be voting on who the next Holy Roman Emperor is, and the Pope certainly had a stake in who that was going to be. Okay. The elector sent von Miltitz over to talk to Staupitz, and Staupitz said to him, "The guy who's to blame for all this and the guy that you ought to shut up is John Tetzel. He's the one that caused all the trouble. He shouldn't have ever come around here. If the guy had stayed out of Saxony, we wouldn't have all his trouble." And I told the elector that, and he kept him out of Wittenberg, and the guy had to come anyway, even though he was told to stay away. And he said, in addition to this, Tetzel and his buddies are giving Rome a false view of the situation. Luther's a nice guy. He's not a hard guy to deal with. You can talk intelligently with him, you know, but all those Dominicans are really messing the thing up in Rome. He suggested to Carl von Miltitz, he says, "Look, you know, don't take my word for it. Talk to the guy." And so he went over and had an interview with Luther, and was favorably impressed by Martin Luther, and they reached a kind of a common consensus that Luther would shut up, that he would say nothing, he would teach nothing further in this area, and von Miltitz would make sure that an impartial judge, who was neither Dominican nor Augustinian, would examine the case and the materials and render a decision for it. He, as long as he was there, he sent word to Tetzel to come and see him. He wanted to hear from Tetzel's side of the story. Tetzel did not come. He sent word again to him to come, and of course he couldn't order him to come because he was a layman, and Tetzel was a member of an order and subject only to the order's instruction. And sent to him a second time, and Tetzel sent word, "I don't dare leave the convent. People will kill me." Now, whether this is true or whether he had gotten extremely paranoid and, mental illness, we don't know. But at any rate, Miltitz went to see him, and he really laid into him, and he gave him the business, and he said, "You're the guy that's responsible for all this trouble we got now. You know, the church is in turmoil. I don't know how we're ever going to straighten this thing out. You know, you dumb jackass, you know, didn't you have sense enough to stay away from this area when you were told to stay away?" He also accused him of theft, of being disloyal to the Pope and to his order, and he told him that he was going to report this to Pope. Well, this killed Tetzel. And, his whole world had crashed around him. 2 years before, he was probably the highest living Dominican in Christendom with his big fat expense account, and he was big Mr. Big Deal, raising money, you know, and he knew all the big moguls on a first name basis. You know, now he's about to get, you know, for all he knew, he might have been kicked out of the church and burned at the stake. Miltitz went to Rome, and he reported that he had dealt with the situation, that it was well in hand, and that Luther was prepared to recant, which is kind of interesting. Tetzel was so ill at this time that he was bedridden in Leipzig, and he lingered on through the summer of 1519. Meanwhile, Dr. Eck, who was the head of the Dominican faculty at Leipzig University, challenged Karlstadt, who was the conservative leader of the conservative group of the Wittenberg faculty, to a theological debate. He wouldn't challenge Luther, but he challenged Karlstadt because he figured Karlstadt was an easy setup. Karlstadt accepted, in spite of the fact that Melanchthon said to him, and Melanchthon was a young, smart aleck, you know. Melanchthon said to him, Karlstadt, you're too dumb to handle Eck. Tell him that Luther's coming instead. You know, Karlstadt says, I received the invitation, I debate. But he brought Luther along with him as his second, and Melanchthon also went along with him. And as we know, what happened in the Leipzig debate was, after a certain period of time, it was very obvious that Eck wanted to debate with Karlstadt certain of Luther's teachings, and Karlstadt finally said, look, Luther's here, argue with him, don't argue with me. And then Luther took over, you know, and they had the big debate. Well, at this was in July, and when it got to be debate between Luther and Eck, it had generated so much public interest that the last session, the last debates were held in the town square, which was loaded with people listening to the two guys arguing theology with one another. One of the ironies of history is that just about three or four blocks away, John Tetzel was lying in his bed dying. And Luther never knew, I think Luther never knew to his dying day, how close physically he was to Tetzel at that time. On July 12th, the debate ended. The Dominicans claimed they won. The Augustinians claimed Luther and Karlstadt won. Of course, we Lutherans all know that Luther won. Luther, in rather short order, went home. Within a few months, unbeknownst to him, but within a few months, would be excommunicated from the church. Tetzel died on the 11th of August in 1519. Very bitter, very disillusioned. You know, his whole career in shambles. A destroyed, bitter man. He was buried under the high altar of the Dominican convent at Leipzig, where you can see his grave today. He was one of the derelicts of the Reformation, a man who was destroyed. He started it and was destroyed by it. And when he died, hardly anybody even noticed that he had died. You know, and so it's one of the sad and remarkable lives of the Reformation. And about the only guy that ever, you know, said anything nice to him when he needed it was Martin Luther. But tomorrow we talk about Cardinal Cajetan, one of the great princes of the church.